Hi, and welcome to Narrative Out Loud, the podcast for Narrative Magazine. I'm Carol Edgarian, editor and co-founder. I'm so excited to be joined today by a dear friend of mine, Lynn Fried. She's a novelist, short story writer, essayist, famously politically incorrect wit with a very big heart and an expansive mind. She hails from South Africa, and she has much to say. Hello, darling.
Hello, darling.
How are you?
I don't know. It's a bit too early to decide.
I know.
That's the first time I've ever been in a closet. So formally.
Yeah. Just to give the visual, we are in a closet of Xerox machines and paper.
Right.
Which is kind of appropriate.
It's cozy.
It's cozy. Yeah. With a bare bulb.
Yeah.
So here you are on the eve of another book coming out.
Right.
How are you doing? It's the god-awfulest question.
I don't know. I mean, I usually take so long between books that to have two coming out at once feels as if I'm playing on both sides of the net. It's bizarre.
Congratulations are in order.
Thank you. I accept them happily.
So you've just published The Romance of Elsewhere, a new collection of essays, the title essay we published in Narrative. And we're here to talk about another essay also in the collection, Enough is Enough. So these essays have been a very long time in coming, seasoning, I would say. Let's talk a little about them.
Well, they've been written over 30 years, I think. I think the first one in the collection was 1986, so
long
30
time.
Years.
Right. Long time.
Right. And
more will be coming?
Ah, I just wrote one, yeah.
I want to see it, hello. So Enough is Enough.
Right.
I remember when you sent this, and it had a little controversy around it, as most of your essays do.
Right. Less than some, actually.
So what was the spark of this one?
Well, I've always been interested in old people. I mean, I have a novel that's just out about old people. I've been interested in old people since I was a child. But so now that I'm an old person, I was terribly interested in what happens to the creative spark is not the word. I think it's a form of self-definition.
Preoccupation?
Well, if you're lucky.
Yeah. So do you remember how, do you begin, and maybe each one is different, but do you begin with a line? Do you begin with a thought? Do you begin with a title? I think you start with a title.
Well, sometimes. I'm usually lousy on titles, but no, this didn't begin with a title. It began with an idea. It began with my having read Jane Gaudin's last trio of novels. Old Filth. I adored it. And then I thought to myself, you know, what is it that has some writers, male and female, blossoming in old age? And then I started looking into it and reading a lot. I read a lot for, I would say, about a year before I came to write the essay.
I love that. I mean, think of Alice Munro.
Exactly.
I mean, there's so many of them.
Many.
Who have just had that extra sprint at
exactly.
the end.
Exactly. Yeah. Jean Rhys. A lot of them. And then there are ones that
Trevor,
exactly. A lot of them that just dry up, you know. But the ones that don't dry up are often what you find that's so enchanting is that lack of desire to sparkle.
Yeah.
It's just there on the page.
Do you find in an essay that you begin in one place and you end in another place that surprises you, or do you kind of know the arc?
I don't know the arc, and it does surprise me. Not necessarily the ending, but the path. I really do just wander around in an essay. And then when I come to do the drafts, I clean it up and try to get the narrative line a little more logical.
You have such a distinctive voice, and this is going to sound like an odd question, but do you hear your voice as you're typing?
Yes, I chat, I talk, I type and I talk aloud.
You do?
Yeah. I talk to myself. And I've been doing this for numbers of books. I didn't do it in the beginning. But then suddenly I started yapping away, and I found myself yapping away.
Yeah, I do as well. And if I find you get to the more authentic voice faster, and also you can hear the bullshit.
Right, exactly, right?
Yeah.
From myself and from others, yeah.
Well, I just want to say, my dear heart, it is so wonderful to be in the closet with you.
Well, it is wonderful to be in the closet with you.
And we're so excited.
Even though I just switched on the machines.
And we're so excited to hear you read.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be a narrative. I can't tell you the number of people from far-flung countries that write to me. They find me, I think, through the website.
Oh, I love that.
Because they've read it in narrative.
I love that. Well, if you haven't read all that we've published of Dear Lynn Fried, go and look, because much awaits. And thank you, darling.
It's such a pleasure.
And now Lynn will read, and I, for one, cannot wait to sit back and hear her roll.
This is Lynn Fried. I'm going to read my essay, When Enough is Enough, Age and the Creative Impulse. Some years ago, a good friend was asked by the Paris Review to conduct one of their long interviews with a much older, much venerated writer. She's done her best work, said the review editor, so it's time to interview her. I was not yet old myself when I heard the story, but it stayed with me, a sort of memento mori with its sweeping surety, the surety of a dairy farmer surveying his cows with dog food in mind. Would such an editor, I wondered, have fingered Yeats during what might have been considered a career lull, before, say, he came to his wonderful poems of old age? Recently, I read a very good novel by a prolific British novelist of whom I'd never heard. It was the writer's 12th novel, published when she was 78. I loved it, and went on to read its companion novel, also good, published 3 years later. Then I went in search of her earlier novels, reading through three of them before I gave up. Certainly they were accomplished, elegant, cleverly wrought, but they lacked what her last two novels had so brilliantly achieved, the feeling, as Somerset Maugham put it, that it was not a story one was reading, but a life one was living. Molly Keane, the late Irish writer, is such another. She wrote 11 novels and a few plays under a pseudonym, published nothing for 20 years, and then, at the age of 77, published Good Behaviour, under her own name, a rollicking good novel that was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. At what point in these writers' long careers might the farmer have pronounced them dog food? And what would he have done with Jean Rhys during her almost 30 years of silence between Good Morning Midnight and Wide Sargasso Sea? Or with Doris Lessing when she veered off into Sufism and outer space? The fact is, writers write and publish idiosyncratically. There are book-a-year writers who might have one book in five one would want to read, if any, and there are book-every-5 or 6 or 7 year writers who might hit it right with one of them, or never, and so forth. Some writers persist into old age, others, many others, run out of strength, of heart, of heat. Even those strapped to the wheel by nature or by habit can find themselves, after years, decades, without the familiar leap in the blood, the joy, the lust, the demon hope. Now I'm more conscious of the possibility that everything could be lost, said Alice Munro at the age of 63, that you could lose what had filled your life before. It's something I would never have been able to think of losing 20 years ago. The faith, the desire, it's not the giving up of the writing that I fear, it's the giving up of this excitement, or whatever it is, that makes you write. What Munro seems to be talking about is not writer's block, but rather writer's fatigue, the dirty little secret whispered among older writers, I'm tired, I'm sick of it, not curious enough to go on after something new the way I used to. Anyway, it's no longer who am I, I've found this out already, it's who are they, and do I care enough about them to find out, when what I really want is peace. To sit in a wicker chair looking out to sea or dig in the garden unobliged to play spouse, parent, grandparent, host or hostess, when all I want is to flee the things and the people that seem to hold me in place, to grab what's left of life and make a run for it. But where to? And won't I, without the work, feel life to be fraudulent? And anyway, how will it be without the work?
without even the pretense of work, the justification of it. I suppose, says Munro, it's like when you don't fall in love anymore. Perhaps. Or perhaps, as for Troilus at the end of Chaucer's Troilus and Crusader, the scope and scale of life have changed, the perception both of space and of time. There, in heaven, Troilus looks down with contemptus mundi at Crusader running around with the Greeks and at the little spot of earth on which he'd been slain. As he looks, he contemplates the vanity of the life left behind, the lust, the falsehood, everything that had mattered so much to him when he was alive. Lust, or at least the erotic in its myriad forms, plays no small part in the life of the imagination. And so, when it begins to seep away, as inevitably it must, what is left to take its place? Ambition? Pride? Rage? Rage would be my guess. Not the rage of regret, but the rage that comes with wasting time, squandering what's left of one's time on domestic chores, social obligations, or, worst of all, working doggedly towards an inspiration that simply never arrives. I think it's a grave fault in life, Philip Larkin wrote, that so much time is wasted in social matters because it not only takes up time when you might be doing individual private things, but it prevents you storing up the psychic energy that can then be released to create art or whatever it is. It's terrible the way we scotch silence and solitude at every turn, quite suicidal. I can't see how to avoid it without being very rich or very unpopular, and it does worry me, for time is slipping by and nothing is done. It isn't as if anything was gained by this social frivolity. It isn't. It's just a waste. I've always found, said Rebecca West, I've had too many family duties to enable me to write enough. I would have written much better, and I would have written much more without them. Contrary to what one may imagine, age, not youth, is more likely to be a time of scatter, of mind, of action, of intention, of desire, a version of what William James termed Zerrissenheit, torn to pieceshood. It used to be that one could field family, guests, phone calls, emails, while never losing touch with the sort of deep, strong undercurrent that could always be counted on to carry one forward in one's work. No longer. Now the impetus to work has to be terrified into life by a deadline, or, failing that, by an attack of hope, the sort of hope that seems to come, if at all, with untrammelled time, free from the interruptions that one seems, somehow and against all sense, to welcome in. As Seamus Dean put it to Nuala Fuelen, endless charities with yourself as donation. But still, the question is, why? Horror vacui? Horror of solitude? Of abandonment? Of loneliness and despair? Just consider the sway exerted over parents by adult children and their families. Would this, could this have happened to those parents during the chain gang years of parenthood, when those children were young? Then at least a mother could be pitied for trying to snatch time back for herself. She was not expected to demonstrate a Troilus-like perspective at the sight of a grandchild throwing a tantrum or trying to twist the ear off a dog. Nor was she assumed to embrace with gladness the role of quiet old bunny knitting in a rocking chair and whispering hush. In ancient Chinese classics of filial piety, it's a standard injunction that adult children, in order to entertain their parents and make them feel young again, crawl about on the floor, acting like children themselves. I'm not sure that observing an adult child crawling around on the floor would achieve much for me. On the contrary, I recently found my arm rising through the air to give my 42-year-old daughter, behaving exceedingly childishly, a resounding slap across the cheek. Silence. At least for a few seconds, blessed silence, after which I was left wishing one could slap any number of people more often. But one can't, of course, at least not if one prefers to stay out of jail or hospital. One must simply content oneself with the sort of mutterings of complaint common among the aged, or behave like a child oneself, demanding, refusing, snatching away from others, or just playing nicely with the toys one has at hand, pen, ink, paper, computer, dictionary, and above all, words themselves. The ability to play is essential to creativity. Why? How? Even Freud declared psychoanalysis unable to throw any light on the matter. What can be said is that creativity requires a sort of openness to discovery, a mood, a mode, a facility of mind free of preconception, by which I do not mean experimental writing, whatever that is. On this I am entirely of a mind with Anatole Breuillard, who said, when something is called experimental fiction, it generally means the experiment failed. Words may be playthings, words and the thoughts to which they give form, but they are not to be taken lightly. You are surrounded by jargon, says V.S. Naipaul, in the newspapers, in friends' conversations, and as a writer you can become very lazy. You can start using words lazily. Expression, Pope famously said, is the dress of thought, thus neatly representing the neoclassical position on poetic diction. Wordsworth, the romantic, disagreed loudly. If words be not an incarnation of thought, he said, but only a clothing for it, then surely will they prove an ill gift. Language, if it do not uphold and feed and leave in quiet, like the power of gravitation or the air we breathe, is a counter-spirit, unremittingly and noiselessly at work, to subvert, to lay waste, to vitiate, and to dissolve. However words are considered, the facility to play with language, to keep it fresh, to keep it coming, this is the challenge to be faced as the years and the books accumulate. One of the dangers along the way lies in the fact that the words themselves can become old friends, too familiar, too taken for granted, too used to each other's company. And so they aren't such fun to play with anymore. They refuse to surprise or enchant. The game lies in keeping language buoyant somehow. Those writers who continued writing well into old age, Beatrix Potter, P.D. James, Penelope Fitzgerald, Willa Cather, Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, V.S. Naipaul, John Updike, Gore Vidal, and these are just a few, those writers, whether or not the writing comes more slowly or as well as ever, have found a way to stay alive in the writing, the demands of life notwithstanding. I have a certain amount of small change intelligence which I carry around for the needs of the non-writing day, said Elizabeth Bowen, but I'm fully intelligent only when I write. Others, like Whitman, Blake, and Montaigne, spent much of their later years rearranging, rewriting, refashioning, essentially repeating what they had written before. Yet others, like Truman Capote, managed to die before they had a chance to fade. A good career move, said his nemesis Gore Vidal. And then there are those who simply stop writing, or at least stop writing fiction. Catherine Ann Porter, after Ship of Fools, E.M. Forster, after A Passage to India, whereafter, as it was said, his reputation went up with every book he didn't write. In the long-term stakes, however, those who come into full flower late, after 5, 10, 20 books, are of a rarer species than those who flare while young and then simply go on, book after book, into the distance. Meanwhile, they are being watched, assessed, judged, and often found wanting by other writers. Here, for instance, is Henry James reviewing Our Mutual Friend. This is, to our perception, the poorest of Mr. Dickens' works. And it is poor with the poverty not of momentary embarrassment, but of permanent exhaustion. It is wanting in inspiration. For the last 10 years, it has seemed to us that Mr. Dickens has been unmistakably forcing himself. Bleak House was forced. Little Dorrit was laboured. The present work is dug out as with a spade and pickaxe. Which was written at a time when poets and novelists stood at the centre of culture rather than on its periphery, before they'd conceded the stage to screenwriting, slam poetry, performance art, rap, video games, and God knows what else. Predictably, James, in turn, came in for a deal of scorn. Would you rather read Henry James, asked Lawrence Durrell, or be crushed to death by a great weight? I'm reading Henry James, said Virginia Woolf, and feel myself as one entombed in a block of smooth amber. Woolf herself had much to say about old age. Why yield a moment to regret or envy or worry, she said, months before committing her body to the river Ouse. Our old age is not going to be sunny orchard drowse. I detest the hardness of it. I feel it. I rasp. I'm tart. What I need is the old spurt. Always, writes Jack Gilbert in his wonderful poem, And She Waiting, always I have been afraid of this moment, of the return to love with perspective. I see these breasts with the others. I touch this mouth and the others. I command this heart as the others. I know exactly what to say. Innocence has gone out of me. The song, suddenly, has gone out of me. And yet here is the song, this wonderfully minor key lament. And there is something invigorating, too, in Wolfe's rasping tartness. The irascible, the disillusioned, the sagacious, the mordant, the meditative, in these can lie the appeal in old age itself. Perhaps because I grew up almost the youngest in a vast family, I was accustomed to old age, comfortably familiar with it, felt it moving with me through childhood and adolescence, at first like a benign shadow of the future ahead, and then, as I grew older, as a sort of doppelganger, so that I did not fear it as much as await its arrival with foresight and bemusement, and after a while, in anticipation of relief from the exhaustion and frenzy of youth. But then, in my mid-40s, I went to Crete, a place whose history, half European, half African, has always intrigued me. I went there alone, making a big deal of wanting 10 days of solitude, no talk, at the other end of the world. I went for a rest, and not incidentally, to write a travel essay. On the night of my arrival, I made my way to the hotel's charming al fresco restaurant, open on three sides to the softness of the September evening, and stood there for some minutes waiting to be seated. But the maitre d' seemed deliberately not to be catching my eye. After a while, I began to feel like a teenage girl waiting to be asked to dance, and so I waved him over. Madame? The place was full of well-heeled European couples, men in signet rings and expensive loafers, their ample women bronzed and bejewelled. There were Germans, Swiss, French, some Italians. Except for the noise of a few raucous children, the talk was on the whole unanimated, desultory, conjugal. Clearly, this was the sort of place to which men brought their wives. A table for one, please, I said. Ah. He hesitated for some seconds and then headed off to a small table between the serving station and a bush. Please, he said, pulling out a chair. But I had not come halfway around the world to sit at a table behind a bush. Being chosen to dance is one thing, being chosen by the fat boy, quite another. No, I said, I can see nothing from here. Folkloric dancing was included in the so-called dining experience, and even though I might have wished to sit that out behind a bush, not being at all keen on folkloric dancing, especially the sort that promises to include members of the audience, Zorba style, I would not, just because I was a woman alone, submit meekly to being placed out of sight. I walked to an empty table that commanded a view not only of the dance floor, but also of the sunset over the Mediterranean, the beach, a pod of Germans emerging from the water, and a yacht anchored out in the bay. Here, I said, sitting down, I shall sit here. It occurred to me, as the wine steward rolled into his spiel, that 10 years ago this man might have found a way to sound me out, make suggestions on the sly. Now he wouldn't dare. It had been a magical transformation, happening so gradually as to be hardly noticeable in the process, like tooth decay. Still, there was real pleasure in the change. I could stroll into town without fielding flirtatious onslaughts from men, and I could sit now in solitary triumph at the premier table I had won for myself and order food and wine like a dowager. I was content. And then the pianist struck up Hey Jude on a synthesizer, and suddenly I was alone in the middle of my life, thousands of miles from anyone to whom I mattered. Even the bored, prosperous couples all around me had at least old habits in common, old quarrels, their boredom itself. Wine corks popped, cicadas soared and screeched in the carob trees. The sunset had turned the whitewash of the hotel bungalows to a pinkish glow, and the air smelled of jasmine and lemon blossoms. The soup was excellent, the wine sharp and tannic. When the dancers arrived, stamping and yelping, I sat back in a sort of sad benignity of spirit. Tomorrow, I decided, I would start on the essay I'd come to write. I'd rent a car, drive around the island, and although I'd never been much of a tourist, I would glance through the guidebook after dinner, mark off what I thought I should see. The car I rented was more like a motorized thimble, but it was thrilling to be off on my own, singing as I twisted and wound up mountain roads, stopping at a village here, a Byzantine church there, and then plunging downhill to a beach to have a swim. This, I decided, this freedom, this spontaneity, these days to myself, this was what I'd come for. I had reached the plateau of my life, a few books behind me, a few more to come, and with old age ambling amiably beside me, I had nothing to fear. And then, on my last day, I decided to visit the Dictaean cave, purported birthplace of Zeus. There was a long, tortuous drive to get there, and then a hot, steep, slippery climb up to the entrance. At the ticket booth, out of breath, I handed over my money. The ticket seller, a dapper middle-aged man with a thick black moustache, grasped my hand in his. "You English?" he asked. "You need guide? Cave very dark and slipperish. Whoops!" He winked, gave my hand a squeeze. "You alone, darling? You sure?" I felt like Mrs. Stone, enjoying the last day of her Roman spring. But I didn't remove my hand. It seemed too ungrateful a gesture, too violent. Somehow he had taken the money without loosening his grasp. I glanced at the queue behind, hoping he'd give me my change and release me, but he just lowered his voice. "When you come out of cave, we have coffee, yes? You promised this for me?" With his left hand, he handed me the ticket. "4 for the ticket," he murmured. "Okay?" I nodded, and he let go. "Don't forget, darling," he called after me. A sour-looking matron handed me a brown tallow candle for the cave. How many, like me, I wondered, pass her every day? Women too craven, too embarrassed to demand their change. I stopped for a moment, thinking I'd go back for it. But the line was moving, and anyway, did I want another scene up there, for the equivalent of a dollar? Was my dignity worth that little? And then suddenly there before me was the cave itself, a gigantic primordial chasm, not cave-like at all, not a slash in the side of a mountain, but an abyss, hollowed deep down into its centre, its yawning mouth and palate hoary with lichen and moss, and farther in, giant bulging pillars of rock, black outcroppings, twists and turns. The air down there was stale, the ancient steps slick and steep. Joining the procession of flickering candles snaking downward, I descended with the silent crowd down into the chill, damp, terrifying darkness. Considering that moment now, I'm put in mind of 11 cartoon I saw decades ago in the New Yorker. In it, the Grim Reaper, hooded, sickle in hand, has shown up at the door of an apartment. "Relax," he says to the woman in the doorway. "I've come for your toaster." One might enjoy the same sort of reprieve, I suppose, if the Paris Review came calling, not to request an interview, but to ask one to interview someone else. Whatever the case, and whether or not writers had already done their best work when they were snagged, the interviews themselves can be wonderfully cheering, if only for the complaints and vituperations that abound within them. The loneliness, the sweat, the rage at critics, the jealousies, the disparagements, the disgruntled, resentful, envious rumpus of it all. Only recently does it seem to have become fashionable to be gruntled with the writing life, to give voice to a sort of cheery goodwill all around and admiration of the competition that seems more at home in Hollywood than in the world of letters. And really, is there anything more boring? All those paeans to mentors, to the fellowship of other writers, those joyful discoveries of truth on the page. "Did you meet Yeats?" the interviewer asks Rebecca West. "Yes," says she. "He wasn't a bit impressive, and he wasn't any sort of person at all. He boomed at you like a foghorn." "I find Faulkner intolerably bad," complains Evelyn Waugh, "and I'm reading Proust for the first time. Very poor stuff. I think he was mentally defective. I remember how small I used to feel when people talked about him and I didn't dare admit I couldn't get through him. Well, I can get through him now, of course, because I can read anything that isn't about politics. Well, the chap is plain balmy. And then there is the spite for the ageing self, still at it, doggedly. After 50, says Henry Green, one ceases to digest. As someone once said, I just ferment my food now. Most of us walk crab-wise to meals and everything else. The oblique approach in middle age is the safest thing. The unusual at this period is to get anywhere at all. God damn. What about the exceptions, though? What about those writers who come suddenly and without warning into full power late in life? And how does this happen, this anomaly of the creative spirit? We don't know. We can't know the mystery that lies at the heart of creativity. What we do know is that time runs out, that worrying about it only engenders panic. Perhaps this is why there is so persistent a thrust toward turning the clock back, 70, the new 60, 60, the new 50, and so forth, until at about 20, the equipoise seems to have been met, and childhood itself gallops forward to the same point, 5, the new 10, 10, the new 17, and so on. Just consider the cult of celebration around birthdays in the later decades. Has anxiety ever run to a higher pitch? So that to utter what either goes without saying or was heretofore unutterable in the company of strangers is to be miraculously unburdened? Listen to the speeches, the catalogues of reverses overcome, ex-spouses and other illnesses, rebellious children, setbacks in the market, and then to the inevitable embrace of ordinary happiness that follows, the sun that shines one day at a time, the treasure of friendship, the blessings uncountable. Nearer, my God, to thee, and pass the nuts, please. Perhaps if extended families were still intact, birthdays themselves would be back where they once belonged, within the family and close acquaintance. There, the journey seems to make sense, with the past and the future all around us, in the persons of those who went before, those who've accompanied us, and those who will follow. Now, however, it is often friends who take the place of family, who flatten out the whole idea of generation itself, who conspire somehow to banish all thought of the certainty of death. So where does this leave the writer in her 6th, 7th, 8th decade, trying hard in a life ever more beset by the din of large and small demands to settle into the sort of silence that makes it possible to listen for her own voice, the sort of silence that somehow was so much more accessible in youth? Have you still got your space, Doris Lessing asks new writers, your soul, your own and necessary place, where your own voices may speak to you, you alone, where you may dream? Oh, hold on to it, don't let it go. I have 3 entire days alone, said Virginia Woolf, 3 pure and rounded pearls, 3 solitary nights. Think of that. Was there ever such a miracle? Not a voice, not a telephone, only the owl calling, perhaps a clap of thunder, the horses going down to the brooks, and Mr. Botten calling with the milk in the morning.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of Narrative Out Loud, a production of Narrative Magazine. I'm Carol Edgarian, and for all of us here, see you again soon.
Creative spark is not the word to impulse. I said.
Oh no.
Oh God.
Okay, hang on. So Lynn accidentally turned on the Rico. Can we stop this?
It's okay. I don't mind if it records.
Okay, so how do we turn this beast
sorry,
on?
I will keep my hands to myself. Thanks, Doris.
Okay.
No problem.
Okay.
I'm just going to check and make sure it's still recording. Yes, okay, you're all
okay.
It happens.
Okay,
so where were we?
Yeah, spark.
I don't think it's spark. I think it's...